This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. And a Merry Christmas, everybody. Today we have two particular items that we're including in the program. First, we have John Ward talking about his experiences as a photo engraver at the time of the Tangiwai disaster. That was on Christmas Eve 1953. The second item covers some detective work on a British war medal from World War I that belonged to Charlie Mayhew. It was found in a house demolition, and through some skillful detective work, it was reconnected with some of his descendants. Okay, first of all then, we have John Ward and the Tangiwai disaster.
I'm Finlay Mason.
And I'm John Ward.
John, an early career that you were pursuing was photo engraving. Now, there was a significant action took place you recall very clearly. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that.
The Tangiwai disaster. At Christmas time, everybody was travelling on the way to Auckland to visit the Queen. She had arrived in Auckland, our brand new Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, and the trains were stepped up. There were some four scheduled for that evening on the eve of Christmas. And the very first one made it as far as Waiuru and then to Tangiwai, where the spillage from the crater lake come rumbling down and torn out one of the supports of the bridge itself, and the train crashed in it, with a resulting loss of 151 lives, and including the firemen and driver. I personally knew the driver's son, a fellow called Jack Parker. He's now deceased. His father was the driver. Jack Parker played in the Fielding Brass Band, as I do in the Palmerston North Band. Now, Jack was incredibly distraught about his father losing his life. Now, as far as the rest of it was concerned, me personally, I was on holiday just for the Christmas in New Plymouth. I'd started work as a photo engraver that month, and the holiday was just for the Christmas, and not till the New Year, but just for the Christmas and Boxing Day, when I got a note from my boss, could I come back as quickly as possible, going into production for newspaper photos that were required for the publications throughout the country. We sent to Gisborne, we sent to New Plymouth, and far south as Masterton. Indeed, the bulk of the centre of New Zealand, we sent all the publications of Hawke's Bay Herald and the Daily News in New Plymouth and Napier, Lyvyn, all the newspapers, there was quite a number of them. These photos had to be produced. I came home that following night, was introduced to the coating glass plates with albumen. It's the base of our negatives. We used wet-back cameras, as they were called, because the negatives were freshly made and still wet, put in a chrome bath and then sensitise them with a silver bath. Then we'd have to store them in a light-proof rack so that the light doesn't ever affect them. Only for a short while, load the camera up with the picture to be photographed, lay the plate at the back in front of the screen that the light shines through from the front of the focal point of the camera. And consequently, we made these printing plates.
Now, John, could I just interrupt? You were acting on behalf of the photographers from many newspapers throughout the country, or was all this material syndicated at this time?
No, it was not. It was from my uncles. I have four uncles. They were reporters in these papers, and one of them was on the following train. He alighted and he caught a bus. They had a special bus that took the passengers around from Taiepi, because the train stopped there. His follow-up train on the express, they had about four running that night, and he was on the second one. He got on a living. He worked for the Times office here in Palmerston North and Livin's, Kerslake and Billings Humphrey. We called that the Chronicle.
And like any good reporter, he always had his camera with him, I take it.
He was really always that and a packet of cigarettes were the two. Yes. So he arrived at the scene. He got off the train, and as a reporter, he had special permission. The army provided the transport to get him to Wairu, to Tangawai. And there. And there was all the reporters, there was an uncle Eddie as well. He came up from Wellington. They all did their job in reporting this crash.
Now, the crash actually occurred during the hours of darkness, so presumably these...
They didn't arrive until early morning. The bedlam was horrendous, apparently. I couldn't imagine the distraught, how the situation... I just couldn't imagine it. I would have hated to be in one of those carriages.
And his photographs were just some of many that came in from other reporters to your office.
Yes, we had. Oh, there wasn't one just in the way of... There was a terrific amount of variation in these reporters' view of things. You'll put it this way. And so everything was different from every source. They also described the conditions of where they latched on. For instance, young Jack Parker, he turned up there and he got interviewed. So he was the son of the driver, and it was he that told me about the fellow that apparently tried to get a light in front of the train to stop the train before it hit the bridge, which has been disputed a lot since. That poor Jack told me that story when I met Jack straight after it. He, in fact, went there. And that was the story that was going on. This character has actually boarded the end of the train, gone through the carriages to the teetering carriage. We went into the carriage and told the people, get out now. And they did, as many as they could. And just as they stood up, the carriage went bang, and they all went in.
Now, as you said earlier, you were actually had started your holidays. You were up in New Plymouth at the time. Communications then weren't quite
just telephone
available.
It was just telephone.
Just telephone. Mm. So, how did you actually get back to Palmerston North so quickly?
Oh, I caught the train from New Plymouth.
Train back there.
It left the following morning.
Right. And so to work. Were you the only one in preparing these plates, or the rest of the company came together?
No, there was only about three of us that turned up. We had to have the camera guy. And I was specialised in the etching part. There was another etching guy as well, and the boss.
How many to serve this publication or these publications? So how many photographs would you think you would have actually processed then?
50 or 60, I wouldn't have thought.
The sort of process is lengthy. It's not like our present day when we photocopy everything. That would have taken quite a bit of time to get through.
The reason we make the negs in the morning, first thing in the morning, is the first job we do is make negatives out of glass plate.
And you'd have done all of them as one batch at that time?
We have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was actually quite an enjoyable job for me. I quite often went to work without having any bothering with breakfast. and the boss always brought about half a dozen eggs in, and it was a job to split the egg and screed off the white, the albumen, and I chaptered the yolk, put all the yolks in a cup.
That was for breakfast later on.
That was for breakfast, morning tea time. I enjoyed that. Mm. But the coating of the eggs was important to get that done immediately.
When you say immediately, so what time actually did you start work?
Usually about 7 o'clock on that condition.
And then by what time would you have had your plates prepared?
The plates would be drip dry by about 8 o'clock.
Then the next process.
Mm. Then the next process, the whole thing takes about 20 minutes.
Mm. Were you then responsible for sending plates back to the various publications?
Yes. There was always Newman's and Airways.
Right.
And the Newman's would be in Napier within 3 hours. And in Whanganui within the hour.
And in some cases you may have had reporters sitting on your doorstep ready to...
When it came to the Standard, it was the Evening Standard, and we had the Times office. And the Times office also dealt to Kerslake, Bill and Humphrey at the time. And the Masterton one was the only one that we sort of could get there just when the bus ran, if we were lucky to catch it. But it was the only... The Gisborne Herald was tremendous. We had a good service to Gisborne with the NAC.
Yes, because these plates would have to be transferred physically. There was no method of electronically sending the image or anything like that.
Truly not, yes. There you see. Etching was... it was time-taking. We had to stop every plate. The etching is done by stopping the plate from and the image from being eroded making it too gaunt with acid. So we'd have to protect the image considerably to allow just a little bit of etching for the ink to carry the image. And in the sinkholes where the etching had taken place, if they didn't run a lot of ink, they wouldn't fill up. And they'd get thousands of runs out of one plate. But the white areas, we couldn't overdo the etching and make all the white areas so that there was no dot there. Etch the dots away, then we'd get sinkage, the paper sinkage into the white areas, and we'd end up with a smudge. So very careful etching so that this position didn't happen. Always proved our work on our hand press.
So the Manawatu Times, which was a morning paper, as I recall, obviously they couldn't carry the story right then and there, but the Evening Standard on that day would have had it.
Not that day, no, they couldn't have had it. They would have had the writing.
Well, that's interesting. Now, tell me, John, what got you into this photo etching career?
My grandfather, little known to me, and I knew little about it. My father said, "John, I've got a job for you." I said, "Oh, really?" Yeah. I was just a layabout after the fifth form.
You had left school by this time?
No, I hadn't left school. He was more concerned about me working, and that happened with my father telling me this, and I hadn't realised it, that his father was a photo engraver, and his father was a photo engraver. In fact, he had started way back in 1840-odd, and built up his business.
Now, the great-grandfather, had he started his career in this country?
No, this was all in England. My father came out from England in 1926. And he carried on in his hobby. His hobby was clocks and watches. He was the watchmaker in town, W.I. Ward, in Waldegrove Buildings. All my life, I was born here. and he'd known this all the time about the photo engraving thing. He didn't want to be a watchmaker. He says, hard on your back, sitting on a stool all day, bent over the watches, he says. Not for you, he says.
Did he carry on both vocations at the same time then, watchmaking and photo engraving?
No, my father wasn't a photo engraver, no. No, it wasn't my father. He was a watchmaker.
And that was just his grief,
it was only his father that was my grandfather. And I bumped into my grandfather when I went to England in 1961, met my grandfather, and bloody hell, he was as tall as my father was, very, you know, how things were now tall, and he had a mind for money. He was 95 or 6 in the shade, and he said to me, he said, I've got a secret for you in photo engraving. I said, oh, yes. It would cost you £5. I said, oh, really? And it was to do with vignetting. I got that much. Vignetting is getting the shades correct in your halftones between black and white. It's the most difficult phase of etching a plate to not get a break. With a sudden break, where the dot becomes an outstanding blob and the hole becomes an open hole with a suddenly you get a hard edge between the black part or the dark grey or light grey into the white. You've got to smooth it right out so that the... And he had a secret in doing this. So I never actually found out what it was. I didn't have £5 to save myself.
So the firm that you joined up with in Palmerston North, and it was an apprenticeship that you...
Oh, yes.
Okay,
they wouldn't have
firm, it wasn't a family firm then?
Yes, it was. There were three families.
It wasn't your family firm,
no,
though? No. Who were the... What was the name of the firm?
Well, Palmerston North Photo Engravers, right. Limited.
And who were the principals in that?
The principals were Jack Sears, and his son Peter joined at the same time as I did. We had two brand new apprentices, he and I, Peter Sears and myself. That was before Christmas.
And there were two other families involved.
And there was Lionel Peters, who had no family. He was the money man. And we had Leslie Crane, who actually did, as a hobby, he looked at the Marching Girls and helped them. And I was doing the recordings for the Marching Girls for their music.
Where were the premises that you operated from?
In King Street. Palmerston North Photo Engravers, just down from the corner of Princess Street, just past the school. First three-story building past the school.
So a business like that, actually, whilst the output was prodigious,
yes,
it took up very little space, in fact. It was a hands-on industry.
Right on, yeah. And everything we produced went out in the buses. And NAC was right across the road.
Yeah.
So that was perfect.
Now, of course, you've spoken of one of the chemicals or compounds you used in the production, that's the egg white. I understand there'd be some other chemicals you'd use that would perhaps...
chromates, silver baths, and the etching. We had an etchant, which was a powder fused under heat. We called it dragon's blood, because it's the colour of it. My sheets and pillowcase was absolutely... It's a couple of days of that, powdering up the plates. It was an etchant, so that when we fused it under heat, it would stop the etching process where we built this powder up as a wall. And, of course, in the halftones, it was all done with paint, by brush, hand-painted, fine, very fine.
What was
that
the
was bitumen. That was bitumen.
And what was the material actually etched then to produce the plate?
Nitric acid.
That was the etchant, and that was... On a metal plate that you etched?
Zinc. And we'd do copper. We had to use sulfuric acid for that.
So you had these fairly aggressive chemicals around the lab.
We had one customer who wanted his photographs of flowers looking like his flowers. It would take all day to proof one flower, four and five colours that we were required to do it. We had a moulding colour, black as a moulder and black as a shading. But then we also had the primary colours too, like your red, yellow and blue.
Your chemicals then were sourced locally? There was an outlet for those? Or you had to bring them in from out of town?
Oh, they were all imported. From Australia, mainly.
Directly to you?
Mm.
And your zinc, was that come as large sheets which you cut to size, or they came in standard plates?
No, they came big, long sheets. They were all each as long as three newspaper pages in one length. They were the depth of a newspaper when you cut them into three, and that was the size, maximum the size we could handle in our etching baths. They were quite large. And the times we did that were for the newspaper ads. For instance, the PDC, when they joined the co-op, they had all these food ads.
Right, so for a full-page ad, you had to have a full-page size zinc plate.
Yes, and the same with the wedding, the crowning of the Queen, for instance. That was a full-page issue of a picture.
Now, of course, newspapers come to mind as a source of your services, but there'd be other firms who would call upon you, printers of some sort?
Yes, we had rubber stamp mouldings etched. You recall ear tags. We started up making the plates for them. They're moulded in plastic from our etched images. Other things like the labels you put on a door, brass labels, that sort of things.
We used to have in Palmerston North Call Sumble Wilkie, who used to produce packaging.
Yes.
Now, was that, again, another client?
Yes, record covers. And particularly cigarette boxes. They were done with huge sheets. They'd be done a half of a big sheet of zinc at once. They were even bigger than newspapers.
So that then was the extent of your client base then? Were there any other sort of interesting...
Well, I was going to mention one part of the fact that the most intense job we had, always gave us a bit of overtime, was the Sunday. We were only on our own to do this. We had to operate all the machines, like the camera and the process, right through to the finish. Where then the photo finishes?
At the local horse racing.
And it was from all over the country. It was usually through they had a racing digest, I think it was called.
So this was just for the record. This wasn't so that the judges could assess who actually won at the time.
No. Well, they may have used them for that in the first place, but we ended up with these long, slit, narrow race finishes for the various courses that were going through the day. And they'd be lining them all up onto one or two sheets of newspaper, and they'd have a whole page of race finishes, and they'd be published on the Evening Standard and while the Times office was going, they ran them too. But that was a Sunday, waiting for us to do this Sunday for their publications on the Monday. We always had the race finishes on the Monday night.
Well, of course, with race meetings at that time probably held every weekend, you had your Sunday was always overtime processing these.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we took it in turns because it was overtime.
Well, John, I think it's interesting to hear about your company's involvement with the disaster that took place at Tangiwai those many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for that. Oh.
And now, Charlie Mayhew's British War Medal.
We have with us today
Andrew Voss,
Jan Harrison, Cheryl Craigner,
Dale Mayhew,
Russell Mayhew,
Jindy Milden,
Judy Milne,
Richard Milden.
And I am Alison Milden.
And Dennis Milne.
Where is he?
He's got to
The story today is actually about a medal and how the finding of the medal has brought us to today. So to start the story, perhaps...
I'll start off.
Okay.
I'll tell the story as it was told to me by the person that found the medal, Aaron Johnston, and because he's not able to be present here for this, Aaron Johnston worked at that time for a house demolition place called Rusty Nail. They were demolishing a building which I believe had been a shearer's quarters on Pioneer Highway, just south of Kariri Road Junction. And during the demolition, they were removing what had been an extension to a part of a building that had been built out over a bottle dump. After they had demolished the building that was the part over where the bottles had been dumped, Aaron told me that he had been shuffling through the bottles and looking to see if he could find anything of interest, and the medal turned up. He found the medal. He took it home and thought about it for a wee while, wondered if he should polish it, and decided that he wouldn't do that. He then looked on Trade Me to see if he could find out if it had any value, and discovered, of course, that they're selling for a considerable price. And then decided himself that that wouldn't be an appropriate way to dispose of it, because it belonged to somebody, and somebody had done an awful lot of hard work to earn the medal. So he then took the medal back to his employer, Jason at Rusty Nail, and the story goes on from there to Andrew.
Okay, from my point of view, my wife had to plaster Jason, and somewhere along the line the story arose that this medal had come to light and it had C. Mayhew on engraved around it, and my wife came home and told me the story, and I immediately said, oh, that would be Charlie Mayhew, and he used to work for Voss Brothers at one time. And so she took that information and was going to take it back to Jason, but in the meantime I had to go into hospital for an operation, and Alison came in and I told Alison the story. And so I probably need to pass over to Alison now to continue.
Well, Andrew thought that my brother Richard, because he had a bit of military history knowledge, might be the person to look for an owner or someone appropriate. But I'm a bit of a family researcher, genealogist, so I went home and immediately started to ferret and look to see if I could find out anything about C. Mayhew, who had in fact also worked for us on the Milden farm as a shearer, so he was familiar to me as a child. Anyway, I managed to ferret quite well and found some current names that I thought might be grandchildren of Mr. Mayhew, which I then passed on to my brother Richard.
So with the name now C. Mayhew, and being a British war medal, the man would have a military record. So I looked up on Archway, which is the website of the Archives of New Zealand, and could check the regimental number of C. Mayhew against the regimental number of Charlie Mayhew, who we knew had served in the Great War as a soldier. And we also knew he had been a sniper as well, and he had told us a number of things about his experiences, or had told my father a number of things about his experiences. The regimental number of the medal matched that of Charlie Mayhew, and so I then contacted Dale Mayhew, who had been one of the chaps that had been researched by my sister, and so I gave him a ring and we had a chat about this and that, and gradually it dawned on me that they were very interested in the medal, and I can pass the story on to Dale now.
Okay, so this strange man rang me up asking me all kinds of personal questions, and I'm thinking, okay, but very quickly we could trace common family members, especially when Richard mentioned Kai Ranger, because I could recall our family members coming from there. So it was reasonably quick that we worked out that we were talking to the right people, and so we discussed a few more details. And after I hung up from Richard, I immediately contacted family members, cousins, brothers, sisters. And met with a lot of interest within the family. Unfortunately, some of my cousins couldn't come, but they were very, very interested in the story. And so it then became incumbent upon me to make sure we got a record of what happened, and to also document and record proceedings. So we're lucky that five of us could come down to meet Richard, and family, and well, we haven't seen the medal yet, so I think we better hand it back to Richard and ask him to take it from here.
Right, well, I'm holding in my hand two items. One of them is an item that is not of military significance, but it was found alongside the medal, and it may have some interest, so I'm passing it over now. It is a medal that is a shield with four battle axes, a knight's helmet, and a shield in the middle with a sheaf of wheat pictured on it. I don't know the significance of it. There is a possibility, though, that the family may know something of it. So I'm passing it over to Dale now. It probably doesn't mean a lot because I can track nothing on the internet that would match that.
It's like a coat of arms, isn't it?
Yes, of some sort. Mm. However, the important matter of the day.
Well, that's something that somebody could take up to research.
It's a brooch. It's a pin of some kind.
Well, I think that Andrew, being closer to the event than I was, the finding.
Right. Okay, Dale. Oh, my goodness.
Andrew is handing over the
medal, the British War medal that was... That was earned by Charlie Mayhew in the time that he spent away during the First World War.
And of course it would have had a ribbon. Mm.
The medal is uncleaned, it doesn't have a ribbon, it's just as it was found.
Whereabouts was it found?
Incredible.
Whereabouts?
In the bottle.
Yeah. That's your old shearing shed?
Oh, yes, it was a shearing... It was the shearer's quarters, apparently, on a Voss farm.
Well, it wasn't quite shearer's quarters.
It
was a cottage that farm workers lived in.
Right.
And there was a succession of workers who lived there.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I think perhaps...
And if you
one
look,
of the things
look
that
around
comes
the rim,
from the story
is
that...
His name.
The smallest thing can just bring together a whole sequence of coincidences, really, and bring together a whole lot of people who didn't know one another before.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I must say, to no small effort on all of your parts, to go to the effort... to do the research and to follow through, and of course the person that found the medal.
I think there was a lot of luck involved too, Dale.
Yes.
Right. My wife talking to Jason.
I know.
We're talking about plastering, of course it was because she's an orthopaedic nurse.
My wife's a plaster nurse up at the hospital, so she does all the broken bones.
That's how
Jason turned up.
Yeah.
It's very selfless of you to do this for us.
If I can just add a little bit, this is Richard speaking again. Our daughter works as the curator of medals and heraldry at the Army Museum, and after the medal was found, and of course lying so long on the ground, in the ground, it didn't have any ribbon with it or anything like that, so I asked our daughter if she could find a piece of ribbon that was the correct one for the British War Medal, and she sent us a piece for it to be mounted as a swing-mounted medal.
That makes a world of difference.
Fantastic.
Wow. That's a piece of original ribbon. It's not reproduction ribbon.
Yeah. And that was her on the phone then, and she's expecting you.
Hope we can get there in time.
We'll
have to find someone who restores the medal.
Pardon?
We have to find someone who may be able to restore the
restoration
medal.
Wouldn't be a great problem. It's silver, so you can clean it just like any silver object.
So it doesn't need a specialist
to do the mounting of the ribbon itself.
Anyway, that's something we can something we can maybe ask her when we see.
Well, Liz will help with this. Let's go to the museum.
It was actually another small coincidence in the story, because the man at Rusty's name, you actually know.
Oh, no, only because I bought stuff for the house from him.
Oh, I thought you said you had taught him.
No.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.